Welcome to the Wealth Matters Podcast, where investors come together to better understand how to build passive cash flow and create generational wealth without all the confusing mumbo-jumbo. Here's your host and co-author of Amazon number one bestseller, Alpesh Pamar.
Welcome to Wealth Matters Podcast. I am going to talk to Mr. Fernando Angelucci today. He's the co-founder and CEO of Self Storage Syndicated Equities, a real estate investment firm with a portfolio of 250 plus million built over just past 4 years. That's amazing. So as you guys can tell, they specialize in self-storage investments, purchasing existing cash-flowing assets. That's the key here. And building ground-up facilities nationwide as well. And if you guys have been listening to my podcast, I am very bullish about mobile home parks, self-storage, and senior housing facilities. I think those three investments are recession-resistant, and they will produce cash flow. So welcome, Fernando.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we start with this question with all the guests. Tell us something interesting or funny about yourself.
Yeah, well, right before we started recording, I was letting you know. Yes. So I've read a book a few times now called Vagabonding by Rolf Potts, which is the forgotten art of long-term world travel. So I've actually been traveling through Brazil for the last 6 months. I'm currently in Sao Paulo, but I'll be returning to the U.S. here probably in about 4 weeks.
Wow, that's crazy, man. I told you, right? I wish I can do it, but I don't think I can do it. But yeah, my friends did call me Vagabond when I was in school. No, this is great. So let's talk about investment and real estate, right? What was your first investment and how did it work out for you?
Yeah, and I'll actually go back a little bit farther. So, you know, I'm the son of two immigrants from Brazil. So they when I was being raised, I kind of had the old school mentality of, you know, go to school, get really good grades, get into college, get really good grades, get a job, work there for 40 years, retire with a pension, right? But then when I was 16,
if you have some.
Exactly. But then unfortunately for them, when I was 16, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and that changed the way I looked at my life and how to build wealth, how to build security, right? So from that point on, I decided I wanted to be a real estate investor. However, my father being the man he is, said, hey, you're still got to go to college and you still have to graduate with a degree that ends in the words engineering. So I said, okay. So throughout college, I read every book I can get my hands on. Wow. I went to every seminar I could go to that wasn't, you know, $30,000 because college kid, I didn't have a lot of money. But there were some good ones for, you know, $900 for the weekend, that type of stuff. And then when I graduated, I ended up going to work for Dow Chemical as an engineer and immediately started wholesaling single family homes. So marketing for them, putting them under contract, selling them. So the very first deal I ever did was I lived in Des Moines, Iowa, is where they stationed me. And every Friday, I would go to the county courthouse and I'd look up all the probate deals that were listed that week. And then I would send them handwritten letters that I would write all weekend long. The size of my wrist muscles, you should have seen by the time I was done doing this. And then I got a call from someone who was going through a probate. They owned a duplex that they wanted to get rid of. So put it under contract. But at the time, I didn't have a buyer's list yet. So I ended up calling the wholesaler that was the largest in that market at the time. And he actually found a buyer for me and we split the proceeds. So that was my very first real estate deal I've ever done. But then very quickly, I saw the cash buyers and how much money they were making off the rental income that they had. So I said, hey, I need to save this wholesale fee income and convert it into passive income or rental income, I should say. So then started buying single family homes, small multifamily homes up to, you know, 7 to 10 units. From there, started focusing on larger apartment buildings and then eventually switched into self-storage in 2016 is when we started selling all of our individual investments and then going into the self-storage side of things.
So before self-storage, you had more single family?
I did a little bit of everything. So that was one of the things I learned as well when I went into self-storage, was the importance of focusing on one asset class and really becoming an expert. So I did, before we were going to self-storage, we had a single family wholesale flipping business, a rental business. We had a multifamily wholesale flipping business, buy and hold rental business as well. We did hard money lending for other investors. Wow. We did short-term rentals. Yeah. I mean, I didn't get a chance to do mobile homes. So that's why, as I told you, I'll be more than happy to invest with your fund, because now my focus is only self-storage. We shut down all of the other companies and all we do now is self-storage. And we have three main avenues within the self-storage space. So the first is finding existing cash flowing properties that are owned by what we call mom and pop operators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Buying them, running them efficiently and professionally, lowering the expenses and increasing the income and occupancy, and then eventually putting them into larger portfolios to either take to the market or to bring to the secondary debt market and refinance on long-term permanent debt. On the other side of the spectrum, I noticed that I was able to buy these off-market deals at really good cap rates until I crossed over about 50,000-55,000 net rentable square feet. As soon as I crossed over that size threshold, then all of a sudden the cap rates started plummeting. And I realized it was because now I was competing with people that had very cheap capital, the publicly traded REITs, you know, the private equity funds. So at that point, I said, I still want large properties like this to help grow the portfolio, but I'm not going to be able to build them or buy them. I'm going to have to build them.
Yes.
So then we started building institutional grade class A facilities. These are typically three stories or more, completely climate control, state-of-the-art technology for security and cameras, as well as access control. And then these projects, as opposed to buying them, you know, buying existing cash flow deals for $1 million to $3 million a piece, I'm building these for $16 to $17 million a piece with final valuations in the $25 to $30 million range, right? And when
which
they're
markets are this ground up, because you are talking about class A, like high end, then those markets have to support these facilities.
Right? Right. So we go to high growth, high population markets. So the Southeast, the South. So right now I have deals in Charlotte, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, Tampa, Florida, Orlando, Florida, right? Anywhere where it's good for mobile homes, it's great for self-storage as well, exactly. You know? So we started working on that avenue, and then COVID hit and it created an opportunity to start our third avenue, and that is adaptive reuse conversions of big box retail stores that have gone dormant. So all of a sudden, you know, before you had these large big box stores that they're trying to lease their space for, who knows, $50 a foot, something insane. And then COVID hit and then they started getting desperate. And now we are able to pick up these, you know, Sears stores, Walmarts, Kmarts, and anywhere between $10 to $20 a foot for the envelope, the exterior. And that allowed us to do two things. One, it allowed us to drop our construction timeline from 12 to 14 months down to 6 to 8 months, because we were already weathered in, if you will. And it also allowed us to drop our total capital expenditures on materials by about 25-30% as well. So the cost per square foot to do one of those deals, as opposed to, you know, a class A deal where all in, you know, total stack, you're looking at $110 to $120 a foot. I'm getting these ones done for anywhere between $70 to $80 a foot. So that's substantial decrease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. So right now your singular focus is self-storage. So let's talk about self-storage. And I have interviewed a lot of people before as well on self-storage. So I want to talk about pros and cons today. So let's talk about what are the pros of investing in self-storage?
Yeah. So if you look historically, I'm an engineer by training. So everything I do is kind of trust, but verify and numbers first, right? So if you look at self-storage and its return since 1994, okay, call it a roughly 25-year period of time. During that time, the S&P 500 returned about 7.5-8% return.
Only 7 to 8, yeah.
Yeah. Multifamily did a little bit better, and that was at about 13%. And this is not counting, you know, the last 4 or 5 years where things kind of got out of hand with COVID. Self-storage during that time returned 17.4%. So that 4% between multifamily and self-storage may not seem like a lot, but you got to realize that's compounding. So if you had $100,000 to invest at the beginning of this study in 1994, what would be the value of that investment today? S&P 500, you'd be at about a little over $500,000. Apartments, you did a little bit better. You know, you're at 1.8 million. Yeah. Self-storage, that same 100,000 would turn into over $4 million in return today. Yeah. Wow. So just to show you what that 4% compounding does, it over doubles your return over the apartment space. Now everyone says, all right, Fernando, great. You know, high returns are awesome. That must mean that it's also very risky. And the thing is, that's actually not the case. And I'll use a couple examples here. The word I like to use with self-storage is that it's asymmetrical risk versus return profile. So let's look at the first one that everybody remembers, 2007 to 2009, when all real estate was getting hammered. The S&P 500 dropped 22% during that time. Multifamily dropped between 7 and 8% between that time. Mm-hmm. Self-storage only dropped 3.5%. Now, that 3.5 was done by a study called the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trust. So they only took numbers from large, slow-moving companies that were set up as REITs. When I talk to a lot of my friends in the space, and you've actually had a few of them on the show already, that was one of the times where they made the most money they've ever made, was between 07 and 09 in the self-storage space. When so, okay.
There is blood on the street, right?
Right, exactly. Now, that's, you say, all right, Fernando, 07, 09, that was, you know, over a decade ago. How about something a little bit more recent in history? Well, according to TREP, which is a commercial mortgage-backed securities research firm, during the pandemic, of the 1,700 CMBS loans that were made to self-storage in the first three quarters of 2020, only three were delinquent. That is a 0.17% delinquency rate. During that same time, multifamily was defaulting at a rate of 1,800% higher, or 18 times the default amount of self-storage, just to show you an example. Now we look at, say, 2021, when we were in the peak of it, right? Really in the thick of COVID. During 2021, our portfolio experienced over 4 to 7% increase in rents month over month, month over month. So in 1 year, on some facilities, we had increases in rents of anywhere between 60 to 80%.
That's crazy.
Right?
So now that I remember, and let me, again, I only have one self-storage portfolio, but what I have learned about it, one, it does not have those three T's, right? Tenants, toilet, and termite, right? Because you don't have to worry about any of that. So that's great. That's one of the, and I think when I studied about it, 2007 to 9, when you mentioned, when people have to foreclose, when they have to short sale, when they have to downsize, they still have a lot of their possessions, which are close to them. They don't want to get rid of them. Where are they going to put all this? Of course, they chose self-storage, right? And even thinking about 2021, same thing. A lot of people started moving back with families, right? Parents and parents moved with son. Now, of course, they didn't have enough space and they didn't want to move around. So where do they put their stuff? Self-storage. So that's why I hear, and again, I'm learning more from people like you, right? That it's become more and more recession resistant.
Right. And then not only to mention those examples that are happening, you know, in very acute study periods, but let's look at just longer term trends and let's look at generations, right? So the two largest generations are the baby boomers and the millennials, right? Yeah. The baby boomers right now are retiring and downsizing in mass. Something like 15,000 people a day are retiring and downsizing. And they're going from, you know, what did the baby boomers learn how to do? They learned how to buy large properties, large houses in the suburbs with five bedroom ranch, what have you. And now they don't need all that space. So they're downsizing and they're going into one or two bedroom apartments. Right. And what are they going to do with all their possessions? Typically, these were people that were raised by parents that went through Great Depression, went through a lot of world wars. So they were taught to hold on to everything because every little thing could be useful one day when the world comes to an end, right? Yep. So they have a lot of possessions they put in storage.
With a banking fiasco, you never know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Now, look at the other side. You have the millennials, which I'm on that spectrum. I'm 31 now. The millennials are typically not wanting to go buy a 5-bedroom house an hour and a half away from the urban center, right? They want to be next to the action. They want to be in the high rise that's above all the cool, you know, restaurants and entertainment and nightlife. And they're willing to opt for a smaller apartment, say 700 to 1,000 square feet, as opposed to 3,000 or 4,000 square feet, and then use self-storage almost as an external closet to their apartment. Yes. They may get a, you know, 100 square foot box, and then they put all their winter stuff in there, or they put all their summer stuff, they put their outdoor gear, and it's just an easier way, as opposed to paying for an apartment that has an extra bedroom or two, which comes at a very high premium inside of cities. They just go, you know, 10 minutes down the line, maybe on the transportation route to their work, or on the drive to and from work, and they just store their things there. And they usually will show up to those storage facilities much more frequently than, say, someone in the baby boomer generation. So really good trends when you're following the generational divide for self-storage. 1 in 9 people use self-storage today in the United States.
Wow, that's crazy. And I'm glad you brought that up, the population, right? So what I have been reading is that the seniors, the baby boomers would be the largest population base by end of this year. And that is why we also started focusing on senior housing facilities. We did a couple of ground up constructions and we've just finished those, as well as buying, you know, existing facilities, because we know these people are going to need places to live. At some point, they will not be able to live in a 1-bedroom or 2-bedroom. They are going to need help, right? So what would be better, you know, help them as well as make money, right?
Exactly.
So this is great. So now let's talk about cons, right? Every coin has the other side, right? So we got to look at both sides. So what are the cons of investing in self-storage?
So let me talk about some of the downsides, and then I'll talk about how to mitigate those downsides, okay?
Sure.
So the very first thing is the compression of cap rates. All of a sudden, self-storage used to be, you know, used to be the ugly stepchild of all real estate, and a self-storage deal wasn't a good deal unless you're buying at a 15% cap rate day one. Right. That's no longer the case.
Right.
We're competing with REITs, private equity firms that are buying these things at 4-5% cap rates, right? So because it became an attractive alternative asset, and because the acquisition environment has become so competitive, brokers have taken advantage of that and are starting to strip a lot of upside out of these deals, because they know that, you know, there's different tiers of buyers. Just because a REIT likes to buy at these cap rates doesn't mean that a REIT grade asset should be priced, or an asset that isn't REIT grade should be priced at those 5-6% cap rates. But the brokers know eventually someone will come and pay that price. So the solution to this one problem of compressed cap rates is to only sell retail, but never buy retail. Mm-hmm. You always buy off market. The other piece is to, instead of trying to buy stabilized assets, go for value add assets or opportunistic assets. So for example, in our company, we've done over 46 transactions across 24 states in the last 5 years. 97% of those transactions were off market transactions. And of those off market transactions, only 2 of them were already stabilized. The remainder of them were all value add projects. Okay. So that's issue number one. Cap rate compression. Issue number two is oversaturation. Now, because these REITs, these self-storage REITs, are making so much money hand over fist, and they're structured as REITs, which means they need to outlay 90% of their income every year, you have a lot of these REITs that are now investing, instead of on a 5-year or 7-year horizon like you and I invest, they're investing on 30 or 40-year time horizons because they have public money, right? So because of that, they're able to go and do land grabs. They'll stake a flag in the ground in a market they know is going to grow, but may not be growing right now. And they'll sit on that land, or they'll develop it all cash with no debt and just let it, you know, slunk along, because they know eventually they'll have market share in that area. The second piece that contributes to oversaturation is cheap construction costs. when I used to build apartment buildings, we were easily at $400-$450 a foot. Storage, when I'm doing everything top of the line, I'm at $120 a foot. So almost 1/4 the cost. But I'm still getting the same rents per square foot that I was getting when I built apartment buildings, right? Mm. So why not just go shift into an asset that has less risk and is cheaper to build? And then the last piece of the oversaturation puzzle is the supply index numbers are dropping year over year. Supply index is a ratio that helps you understand what the supply and demand equilibrium is in a given market. So it is the amount of currently available net rentable square footage of storage over the population in your trade area. Mm-hmm. So how do you mitigate this oversaturation? Number one, don't play where all the big players are going right now. So the importance of underwriting and doing feasibility studies, not only internally, but also externally, getting third-party studies to make sure you don't have rosy-colored glasses on. Right. And going into areas that you know will grow and will have REIT presence, but may not have REIT presence right now. So for example, what we do, here's one of my deals that's coming up in the next couple of weeks, is in Charlotte, North Carolina. But it's not inside Charlotte, North Carolina. It's in a suburb of Charlotte, North Carolina that is growing extremely fast, but has no Class A product yet. So we are always going to be the ones that come to the market first with a Class A offering when all the Class C offerings are full and the customer is demanding a more professional experience.
I see.
Right. And then now the last piece, the last con would be what I've been alluding to is your REIT competition. They have unlimited capital that is needing deployed. They invest on 30-year timelines. And that's why we always like to focus on just outside of primary markets or even secondary and tertiary markets, depending on what asset class or what asset grade we're going for. Right. Class A stuff has to be in primary markets in what I call the exurb. So the area between suburbs and rural. That is in the path of progress, or if we're buying existing facilities and we want a good cash flow portfolio that we can put together of 10 to 20 properties to eventually sell off for a good premium on the cap rate, then we go to these secondary markets like Columbus, Ohio, or Des Moines, Iowa, right? Areas like that.
That's awesome. So let's talk about the real estate market now, because I really want to know what's going on, right? So how do you see the real estate market react during second half of this year?
Yeah, so I think despite all the banking issues that we're seeing right now, I think the Fed is going to still push towards curtailing inflation.
I hope so.
Right? So I believe rates will continue to go up before they start going down again.
Right.
What we've noticed is depending on the type of debt, this can have an effect or not have an effect, right? It can have both effects at the same time. So if you're going towards short-term debt, like five-year paper, the Fed funds rate is increasing your cost to borrow.
Yeah.
And in those situations, to get around the increased debt service coverage ratio that is required from us, we are now, instead of offering outright purchases to our sellers, we're saying, hey, would you be willing to carry paper? Would you be willing to be the seller finance for us? Or, hey, we have a large project here. We think your land is worth a good amount and we can get a lot of credit for that value. What if you come in to the partnership as a joint venture partner and you contribute your land to our venture? We'll do everything. You don't need to do anything other than just deed over the land to the So what we've been doing is having these sellers deed over their land into the partnership, which then allows us to do two things. Number one, we don't have to raise as much capital because we're getting to use the full appraised value of the land. Because usually as good property finders that buy properties off markets, we always get penalized on the appraisal. You know, the appraisal will say, hey, your land is worth $3.5 million, but you bought it for $500,000. So we're only going to give you $500,000 in value for this land. And this is one way to get around that, which means we don't have to raise as much capital, which means our limited partners get a much higher return. Okay. Now, where it can go in our favor is, say, right now, where you start getting, say, 10-year paper, and you're looking, now you're basically trading off of the treasuries and what the bond market is doing. And every time the Fed raises rates, the bond market freaks out. They think that they're, that the Fed is going to raise rates into a recession. So when you look farther down, the cost of that paper is much lower. And so I've had times where I was doing a deal looking at both 5-year and 10-year paper. The 5-year paper went up in price the day after the Fed raised rates, but then the 10-year paper dropped basis because traders thought that we're going to raise into a massive recession, right?
Got it. No, that's awesome. That makes sense. So let's talk about the mistakes you have made. What kind of mistakes have you made with your investments so far? And what did you learn from them?
Right. So knock on wood, I haven't lost any capital in the self-storage space, but I'll give you a story of when I was in the apartment space. And actually, I went on a podcast with Wellings Capital called How to Lose Money, where I detailed this. I gave a 45-minute explanation how I lost money.
Yeah.
But this is one of Paul. Yep.
Yes, Paul Moore.
So
great guy.
What we did was, right, exactly. He was a good friend of mine. We had a deal. This is when we were very first starting out on the lender side of the world. And we had an investor that came to us to borrow money in the second position. All right, red flag number one, borrow money in the second position to buy 2 apartment buildings in Indiana. Well, turns out she defaulted on her second position almost immediately within 6 months. And then we had to do a workout to take her her ownership. So she wanted to do a deed in lieu, if you will. So we did a deed in lieu, and then we also found out that she was defaulting on her first position. So then we had to structure a buyout with the first position to take the property back as well so that he couldn't foreclose on our second. After all of that, we ended up taking the property back. It was in the middle of nowhere, which was unfortunate. We learned that now every deal that we do, we have multiple eyes on the property physically, not only our own, but you know, our lenders, our engineers, our property condition assessment, everybody. And we ended up losing quite a bit of money on that deal. I think it was close to $150,000 to $200,000 that we lost on that deal.
Wow.
So that was a long time ago. I think it was 2014, I believe. And one of the big issues, which is one of the reasons why I switched into self-storage, is the eviction process.
Yes.
So self-storage, we don't have evictions. We have auctions because it's lien law, property law, as opposed to tenant-landlord law. And one of the issues with that property was the person, our borrower, was unable to collect payments as soon as the transfer went over from the seller to the to our borrower. All of the tenants, almost 90% of the tenants, stopped paying rent. And what we found out was one of the tenants found out about the sale and sent and basically knocked on all the doors of the other tenants, the neighbors, or sent them a letter saying, hey, there's new owners that are out of town. Everyone stopped paying their rent.
Wow.
So one bad egg was able to cause that issue across all of them. What I like about self-storage is we don't have to wait for sheriffs to serve notice. We don't have to go through that whole process that on some of those tenants lasted 8 months to get them out. I was doing everything we could legally, but they had professional tenants in place, people that knew that you can yank out the fire, detector, the smoke detectors, and that would delay the eviction process, things like this. So in storage, when someone doesn't pay, we give them a grace period. If they don't pay within that grace period, we automatically start the auction process. They're automatically overlocked with a manager lock that takes 15 to 20 minutes to cut off with an angle grinder. And if they don't pay within that time, within 30 to 45 days, I sell all of your stuff online to an auction buyer. And I have usually a tenant meeting the auction buyer that's cleaning out the unit same day to move into that unit. So not only do I not lose any time, but I also get to recover funds very quickly because of the auction process, right?
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So this was great. Thank you so much for sharing all the golden nuggets. Are you ready for fire round?
Let's do it.
Would you be changing any business or investment strategy because of inflation or recession?
Yeah, and we already alluded to the fact. So now, because of interest rates going up, we have been getting creative on our deal structures with the sellers, either bringing them in as equity to basically take advantage of the newfound value and not get penalized on us finding a good deal, or asking them to become our financiers and being able to negotiate well below market interest rates and terms that we usually wouldn't be able to get from a bank.
Favorite investment, real estate, or business book?
I'd have to say my favorite would be Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss.
Yeah, it's a great book.
I read it once a year easily, and it's not just about negotiation. It's about being a good listener, about having what he calls tactical empathy. So it's good for your business. It's good for your marriage. It's good for your relationships with friends and family. It's one of my favorite books of all time. It's one of the books that I've bought and gifted the most to almost everybody that has asked me for advice in this area.
I have it on my Kindle, and I'm thinking of just buying a physical copy because now I enjoy physical books. So yeah, no, that's a great book. Any tool or website you recommend or you cannot live without?
That's a good one. So because of our industry, the two tools that we like a lot are Esri. Esri is a kind of demographics, I believe it's from ArcGIS, business analyst, I believe is the true name, but we call it Esri. That's one to help with demographic data, see where markets are going, if population makes sense, income, median incomes makes sense. And then also the third party, basically phase one feasibility websites. So your Yardi Matrix, your Radius Plus, those are all really good. We also, we like to use CoStar is another website that we find a lot of value from. All commercial investors, I'm pretty sure, use it now.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Any advice for beginner investors?
Get started. There's never going to be the perfect time, and you just need to take massive action and not look behind you. One of the things that I didn't tell you on this podcast, I usually say on others, is how I quit my Dow Chemical job. I basically burned all the bridges because I knew if I had a way to get back in and things got tough, I would take it, right? That's how human nature is. Nobody's willpower is perfect. There's always times where you falter. So to get around that is to set up systems around you to make it harder and harder to fail at what you're trying to do. A great book that talks about this is Atomic Habits. It's a really good one.
Yeah, James Clear, man. Yeah, he's so clear. How do you give back?
How do I give back? So self-storage is one of those things that is extremely hyper-local. When you look at our trade areas, unlike, say, multifamily, where you can have someone moving across an entire city to a new multifamily residence. Self-storage, typically you're within a 5 to 15 minute drive time or 1 to 5 mile radius of your facility. So what we like to do is, because the local community, that local trade area is supporting us, we like to in turn support them as well. And this can take form in many ways. We usually leave it up to our managers to find things that are important to the community. So it can be funding for battered women shelters. I love dogs. I'm a big animal guy. So we also like to support animal shelters, little league teams we've done in the past. When police officers have these food and clothing drives or back to school drives, we usually participate in those things as well. So for us, the biggest thing is making sure that it's local and that it's a part of the community that is supporting us.
Well, that's great. How can my listeners reach out to you?
Yeah, so this is one of the crazy things I do, but I love it because of the response. I have found that, again, with Mr. James Clear here, the more barriers you put for someone to reach out to you, the less likely they will. So I'm just going to give you my cell phone number. It's area code 630-408-8090. 630-408-8090. That is my real cell phone number. So shoot me a text message, give me a call. Text is a little bit easier because I'm in meetings all the time. That's one of the easiest way. If you're not as brash and you're a little bit more, you want to do something a little bit slower, you can go to our website, which is SSSE.com. SSSE.com. And they'll have all our information, ways to contact us, and a little bit more passive ways if you don't want to reach out directly to me.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Fernando, for your time today.
I really appreciate it. It was a good time here.
Thanks for listening to the Wealth Matters podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so others can enjoy the show too. Have a great week and happy investing!